Welcome to the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR, where we talk to business leaders from around Ireland and share their advice on how to create the HR systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, simply visit www.insighthr.ie/podcast. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Okay, let's get started.
Welcome to the second episode in our two-part series, which discusses bullying in the workplace. In our last episode, we looked at the steps that HR can take to help prevent bullying happening in the first place. While on today's episode, we'll be looking at exactly what can be done if someone in the workplace reports that they are being bullied. I'm joined by HR consultant extraordinaire Liam Barton and founder and managing director of Insight HR, Mary Cullen. Welcome both.
Thank you, Sarah.
Liam, in our last episode, we touched on some of the behaviours that amount to bullying. Is there a legal definition for bullying in the workplace?
There is, Sarah. That there's a definition which has been, I suppose, defined for a long time in terms of the area of bullying. It comes originally from the report of the Task Force on Bullying, which took place back in 2001. And it's been defined in both the codes of practice that have been published in this area. Workplace bullying is repeated inappropriate behavior, direct or indirect, whether verbal, physical or otherwise, conducted by one or more persons against another or others at the place of work and or in the course of employment, which could reasonably be regarded as undermining the individual's dignity at work. And I suppose there's a couple of things there. It's interesting to note, Sarah, that the definition hasn't really changed in 20 years. So I think it was well defined originally, and it's remained. So I suppose in terms of looking at bullying, the areas I'd highlight is the repeated nature of it. And bullying, and it's been examined in the courts and the WRC, has to be pervasive. In other words, it's not just something that happens occasionally or you know, once every 12 months. It has to be repeated. And it has to be almost systematic or pervasive in the workplace. And it is inappropriate behavior at the place of work or in the course of employment. And the important aspect there is, of course, it extends the bounds in terms of what could reasonably be work-related. So Mary and I, in our experience, have investigated many incidents or allegations which have taken place during the course of employment, but not necessarily at the place of work. So it could be a company barbecue, a Christmas party, a golf event, any aspect which essentially there's an organization or would have been organized or would only have taken place as a result of an employment or a company. And it's really pervasive behavior which undermines the individual's dignity at work. And I think it's important for employers and everyone at work to understand that definition, because I think it is a word that does get thrown into the mix on occasion. And we would come across, scenarios where there's an allegation of bullying, and really looking in at it, even at the outset, we can see that it's not really bullying. It may be poor communication style. It may be a clash of culture or personalities. It may be where there are performance management or disciplinary issues that are masquerading as an allegation of bullying, but it's important for all parties to be aware of what the definition actually is.
Mary, something like this, like we all might understand that it should be dealt with straight away, but we know that this isn't always the case. Why do you think that this is, and why is it so important that we follow up straight away?
Yeah, I think it's a complex area, and sometimes people really don't understand that when somebody comes to them with a complaint, that it is bullying in the first place, because the employee themselves may not have bought the complaint under the dignity at work policy or under the bullying policy, and line managers might not immediately recognize it as such. I also think sometimes, particularly as you go up the levels in an organization, once it starts to involve managers, supervisors, senior managers, sometimes organizations are fearful about, you know, the implications of those kind of allegations against senior management, and they delay or drag their heels or don't move in a timely enough fashion to resolve matters. And you'll note from the new code of practice that, you know, there's a real emphasis now on the informal resolution. And there's two stages of informal resolution that the new code of practice refers to, before ever moving towards an investigation, and an investigation becoming the last port of call. So that puts back the onus on line managers to resolve in an informal way as much as they possibly can those kind of allegations as they come up.
And what would that informal process actually entail? Is it just having a chat with everybody? How would an informal process work?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the first instance, you will be asking an individual if they feel they can approach the person or the people involved and speak to them directly themselves. Oftentimes, though, when somebody has raised an issue or an allegation of bullying, they often bypass that step because they're fearful to do so. It could involve informal facilitated meeting between the manager and the employees concerned. It could involve the manager speaking directly to the alleged perpetrator and trying to resolve matters in that way. It could involve mediation or some other solution that the employee feels would resolve the matter satisfactorily. But I think it's also important that, you know, within the code of practice and for managers to understand that there is an obligation to record notes in relation to whatever action is taken. And that would involve what was discussed and what outcomes there were, so that there is that, I suppose, trail of management attempt at resolution.
Liam, as we have kind of alluded to in this episode and indeed in the last one, this code of practice on bullying was recently updated. Can you give us like a brief run through of some of the recent updates that HR should be aware of when it comes to dealing with a complaint of bullying?
Absolutely. I think one of the interesting areas, which I would highlight, Sarah, having read the code of practice, is the emphasis that's being placed on the investigation. And I think heretofore, while there was a reference to an investigation, I think this very, very much copper fastens really the onerous requirements in terms of an investigation into the area of bullying. So the code of practice itself refers to terms of reference being issued, timescales and procedures being adopted in terms of the investigation. And I think it also highlights that the scope of the investigation should indicate that the investigator will decide based on the facts before them whether the behaviour complained about may, on the balance of probabilities, have occurred. It also highlights, for the first time, I think the person nominated should have the appropriate training and expertise required to carry out an investigation in line with the procedures involved. So while the code of practice doesn't say it's obligatory to get an external HR party, an external third party, to conduct an investigation into bullying, I think it's putting a real high bar in terms of the qualifications, the processes, the skills, the expertise required to carry out an investigation in this area. So while it doesn't preclude an internal investigation, it refers also to possible conflicts of interest in terms of managers' investigation within their own department. So one of the takeout points I would take is really, if an investigation is required, I think an organization and its HR department will have to look at and ask themselves a couple of questions. Do they have the expertise in-house to carry out the investigation? Can it be carried out fairly, independently, and impartially? Are there possible conflicts of interest? What's the level of expertise in-house? How many investigations have been carried out heretofore? So I think there's a possibility that it may have copper fastened the idea that, or the requirement for an external qualified resource to come in and conduct an investigation. Other areas, it's reinforced, as Mary has alluded to, the importance of the informal process. And I think everyone would like to see matters of this nature resolved informally without them having to go through a formal process, because I think it's better for all parties involved. And I think it's highlighted the role of the contact support person as an educational person only, rather than being an advocate or involved in any specific issues. And finally, I'd say, Sarah, it reinforces the whole area which we've spoken about in our previous podcast of the culture and values of the organization itself. And I think this is something that all of us within organizations can learn in terms of what type of culture and values do we want within the organization. And I think if, in particular, if the senior management team can define that and set it out among the organization and achieve buy-in, there'll be less kind of emotive requirements for investigations in this area.
And isn't there also a requirement which might be relevant to perhaps smaller businesses, that there needs to be a separation between the investigation process and any resulting disciplinary action in terms of who is dealing with it? Is that the case?
That is the case, Sarah. And it's a very, very important point that you raise, because in many of the cases on occasion, which I would come across and Mary would come across at Insight HR, where, for instance, there might have been a dismissal or we're hearing an appeal, or there might be disciplinary action or retraining might have taken place. In many cases, there's a blurring of the lines between the investigatory process and the disciplinary process. And in essence, there should be a separation between any investigatory process and any disciplinary process. And there shouldn't be contamination of the two processes. And I do find at times there's a blurring of the lines, or even there's a lack of understanding within organizations that you should have an investigation. It should be clear what is being investigated. Is it an investigation that is solely coming to findings of fact, and not issuing recommendations? Or is there, within the terms of reference, the scope to issue recommendations to parties? And occasionally we come across where very much the lines have become a little bit blurred, and even the employee themselves is unsure, well, is this the investigatory process or is this the disciplinary process? I'm unsure where exactly I am. And I think there really needs to be clarity in this area. And again, I think that's where a role of an independent third party coming in entirely independent and objectively looking forensically at the issues and being able to come with an independent investigation report can play a real positive effect, because I think that gives a degree of clarity and certainty to all parties within the organization that we've taken the decision to get an external qualified professional independent body to come in and look at this. Here are the findings that they've come to, and on the basis of the findings, we're going to take the appropriate action, whatever that may be.
I think it's also important just to highlight that, you know, particularly when you've got HR managers in standalone positions and they take on an investigation themselves, you know, maybe for the first time. And while they may be appropriately qualified in that they understand bullying and the definitions and have read the code of practice and be very capable in their own right, sometimes time just does not permit for them to get through the process in any kind of reasonable time frame, and they can find themselves very severely criticized later for having undertaken the investigation, taken far too long to complete the investigation, and meanwhile people waiting for an outcome and in a bit of limbo. So I think it can be, you know, from HR perspective, once you outsource that, you know, your role becomes about coordination, not about the actual work involved in the investigation. And they can be very long processes. I mean, Liam, I know you and I have worked on some mammoth investigations that, you know, have been quite complex. And you really do need to have a very good understanding of employment law and codes of practice and legislation and case law, as well as the ability to manage multiple parties all at the same time. The longest investigation that I've ever personally conducted has taken place over the course of a year. But I was able within my investigation report to set out each and every step that I took and explain all delays that were encountered during the process. And that's important. You've got to look from a HR perspective. Do you actually have the capacity to carry out an investigation and spend the time analysing and writing the report uninterrupted? And certainly from some of our clients, I've had HR managers just pulling their hair out, trying to complete these reports at the weekend, late at night, before work starts, because let's face it, the HR role is extremely busy always. And you may not have the time during the working day to devote to doing that analysis and report writing.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make, Mary. And I think another point just to build on that is, what support is the HR manager themselves going to have? Because at Insight HR, we will always have our head of investigations or an investigator supported with a HR support person. So in terms of issuing documentation, preparing interview questions, liaising with the different parties, seeking information, getting emails and bringing it together in an investigation file. So as I say, if you have a standalone HR person, you know, they're also going to have to prepare the interview questions, arrange the transcripts, edit them possibly. There's a huge volume of paperwork alone that they're going to have to look at. And as you say, they're dealing with, you know, possible IR, ER issues, they're dealing with GDPR, they're dealing with the right to disconnect, staff handbooks need to be updated, various policies and procedures. So I think when you look at it in that context, it's a huge project for any standalone HR person to take on, and not alone from a capability or a qualification or experience point of view, there's a huge amount of work to be done in it.
And I think also, Liam, you know, from a GDPR perspective, you know, we now have a number of different steps that we must take before ever we interview people to confirm that they're happy to be recorded, to get their consents. And sometimes there's a huge job of redacting statements, you know, that one person shouldn't see this and the other person should see that. And it can become a very big job. So, you know, I would always be concerned when, you know, standalone HR people attempt to conduct an investigation themselves, unless it's for reasonably small matters that they can deal with in a reasonably timely fashion. If it's more complex, and certainly bullying falls into that category, you know, it's in some ways an organizational crisis when you have allegations of bullying. And it's very challenging from a management perspective, from an employee perspective, and from a HR perspective. And, you know, the more senior the allegations are, or, you know, the more senior the person is against whom allegations are made, the more challenging that whole process becomes.
Mary, let's say that I come to you and I say, Liam has been bullying me. What are some of the steps that you would take to address this?
Well, first off, I would be absolutely shocked to hear Liam is bullying you, because he's an absolute gentleman, and certainly that is unlikely to happen in our organisation. But that being said, as any business owner, as any senior manager, you have to be open to the possibility that something like that might be occurring, even though somebody like Liam, you know, would be hugely trusted in this particular business and hugely respected within this business. If you came to me and said that Liam was bullying you, I would have an obligation to take you seriously, listen to what you have to say, attempt to resolve matters informally in the first instance if I can, either by encouraging you to speak directly to Liam himself, or by facilitating a meeting between you, by me speaking to Liam, by maybe bringing in a mediator. And in the event that all of those things failed, or you felt a formal investigation was the only way forward, you know, we'd really have to think, who in this business could investigate an allegation like that against Liam? And in real terms, I'm probably the only person more senior than Liam in the business. And would it be appropriate for me to do so? I would say not. I would say, again, I would have to outsource that, even though we have everybody within the organisation here capable of carrying out a workplace investigation or being involved in a workplace investigation. There would be an onus on me to outsource that too, and make sure that your complaint against Liam was heard impartially and fairly, and that if an outcome involved Liam bullying you and that being upheld in an investigation, that I would have to address that appropriately through the company's disciplinary procedures. I'm so sorry to include you in this process, Liam, because again, it's so unlikely. I see you laughing there, Sarah, but it is unlikely.
One would hope
anyone who has met Liam, and I'm sure it comes across on the podcast, he really is one of the nicest people ever. So yeah, the idea of him bullying is, it's not very realistic, really. And just for the sake of impartiality, well, for fairness, really, Liam, I'm going to ask, do you have anything to add to the process?
The writer replied, thank you, Sarah. I think in general terms, one of the things looking in at this area that has always struck me is speed of response. And I think if someone is coming to the owner or managing director or HR practitioner within the business and saying, I have an allegation of bullying, it isn't something that happened 5 minutes ago or a day ago or a week ago. It's something that's probably built up and up and up and up over a significant period of time. And one of the, I suppose, the regrets I would have for organizations and people within organizations, that at various times, there must be an opportunity to sort of almost let the air out a little bit, for want of a better phrase, and sort of, you know, deflate the buildup and perhaps the tension and the experiences people must be feeling. So I think speed of response is very, very important. It's probably a tacit thing, and it's more difficult now because we don't have the water cooler moment. We don't have the canteen. We don't have perhaps as much of an ear to the ground. And I think HR would be a great temperature check within organizations. But with COVID, it's becoming more challenging because people are remote, etc. So I think speed of response is a huge thing, that wherever there's a concern raised, that HR or whoever's responsible for implementing the policy moves on it extremely quickly. And there's nothing that I think upsets people more than a concern being raised and it taking an elongated period of time for that concern to be addressed. I would absolutely echo what Mary has said in terms of the importance of the informal approach. And the sooner, in my experience, that the informal approach can be facilitated and encouraged, the sooner people can get talking and mediation possibly can take place, the better. Because I think the longer it goes without things being addressed, the more difficult and emotive it can become. And I think particularly for the person who's bringing forward the allegation of bullying, they can begin to feel this is not being taken seriously by the organization. You know, they have a policy and procedure, but I've yet to see the person against whom I've made the allegation, or I've made the allegation, I haven't heard anything back. That can compromise the trust of the person in the process. So in other words, if someone does bring forward a formal complaint, they put it into the HR department, they don't hear about it for weeks, they don't know the status, and then they start to lose trust and confidence in, one, the process, and two, that their concern is actually being taken seriously.
Also, I think if concerns are raised about senior managers, you know, as an organization, irrespective of how you feel about those individuals, it's really important that you're seen to be fair at all times, and that there's nobody within the organization against whom the organization will not take the appropriate steps. From a bullying perspective, it can have such a terrible psychological and physical consequence for a person when bullied, and that the organization really need to take it seriously and address it, no matter who it involves, whether that's the chief executive, managing director, senior manager, colleague to colleague, contractor to employee, supplier to employee. I would always urge HR to acknowledge the complaint very quickly and move to resolve very quickly. And if all else fails and you can't informally resolve a complaint, well, then you must carry out an investigation. It's not an option not to. And you must protect all the parties involved, not just the person who has made the allegation. Remember, the person against whom an allegation is made is innocent until the end of a disciplinary process where the organisation decides whether or not bullying has occurred.
And Mary, in the more serious cases, a workplace investigation might be the only way forward. Now, that's a huge topic and far too big to pin on the end of a podcast episode. But where could somebody go if they're looking for further resources on this?
Well, our own website would have a lot of resources because we specialise in workplace investigations. We do have a specific division. So we write quite a lot of blogs around the whole area. We have recorded webinars on it. We have podcasts on it. So there's a lot of resources there. Code of practice, of course. You know, anybody who's developing a policy or looking at training in this area or looking at awareness raising would be going to the code of practice. And, you know, there's a lot of good blogs out there written by employment lawyers, which can be accessed. And the WRC themselves have a great resource in old cases that an employer can look at or a HR practitioner can look at to kind of build up their knowledge in this area. But I would say there's many different resources. What I would say, be careful that you're looking at Irish resources rather than finding something on the internet that's maybe Australian or from the UK or American and getting confused. It's important that you're going to legitimate sources of information on this whole area. And of course, there's always books.
That's brilliant, Mary. Thanks. And thanks to you both for joining. We've come to that part of the episode now where we test how much I was listening and how easy it is to read my writing. So I'm going to try and summarize some of the topics that we've talked about today in three key takeaways. So my takeaway number one, and please jump in if I'm going off topic or if I'm saying something that doesn't make any sense. My takeaway number one is that everyone should know the definition of bullying, first of all, when it comes to dealing with an allegation of bullying, and to act on it straight away. And the code of practice defines bullying as actually being a repeated behavior that could be seen as an affront to dignity at work, and it can happen in the course of employment, not just in the workplace. But really the emphasis there is that it's repeated. My second takeaway then is just going back to that newly updated code of practice, which organizations need to be made aware of. There has been some kind of, I suppose, changes or updates to it. One of which is that it places a lot of emphasis on the investigation, the resulting investigation, how that investigation is conducted, the timescale of the investigation, the expertise of the investigator, and the procedures which are followed. It also places emphasis on the importance of the informal process, which, as we've discussed today, could be, recommending that the person making the allegation speak directly to the person themselves. Obviously, that might not always be the kind of easiest thing for somebody who's being bullied to do, in which case there's also the options of facilitated meetings. A manager could speak directly to the person being accused of the bullying, and there's also mediation as well. But those kind of, I suppose, those processes would need to have the participation, the willing participation of everyone involved. And as well as that, the newly updated code of practice also places emphasis on the culture and values of the organization. And that's something that we really touched on in our last episode on how to prevent bullying in the workplace. So I would advise everyone to go and check that out if they haven't yet listened to it. And then my third takeaway, is that there's really huge value in getting somebody else to do the investigation and in looking for a third party to actually conduct it. What that can do is it can satisfy the need for fairness and impartiality, as well as the need for the separation of the investigation process and the disciplinary process. Investigations can be time vampires, they can take up a lot of time. And so for the busy HR managers of today that have to deal with all other kind of HR tasks, this might be something that causes the investigation to be drawn out over a longer period of time, which isn't always ideal. And involving a third party can also sidestep any conflicts of interest that may occur, as well as satisfying the need for a certain level of expertise and training. Did I summarise today's episode okay?
I'm impressed, Sarah. You were listening.
I was actually listening to you guys. Once, eh? Brilliant. Well, look, I'm glad that I got that right anyway. It's always a test at the end of each episode. So thanks a million for joining us. And as I say, if people want to catch the first episode in this two-part series, then please do over on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back soon with another episode. Thanks, Mary. Thanks, Liam.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for joining us today on the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR that helps you create the human resources systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, go to www.insighthr.ie/podcast. That's www.insighthr.ie/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe, like, and share the show with any friends and colleagues who are looking for fresh ideas on how to create the ideal workplace for their business. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or an on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Thanks, and see you soon.